You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 10th of August 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and indeed review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Andrew Muller and Chloe Potter.
Coming up on today's programme, we welcome back literary agent Claire Conville for her top tips for your summer reading.
Our guest music reviewer this week is Farih Bradley, the radio presenter, sound artist, DJ and events curator, who will be sharing some interesting tracks with us, including this.
And we'll be taking a cultural tour around Hamburg.
Hamburg is home to the second biggest seaport in Europe. The docks are very much a part of the city's centre, and they make a fascinating destination for sightseers.
Plus, we'll assess the state of the photography scene in the southern United States. So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. And indeed, welcome to Studio One at Midori House. Welcome to The Review and welcome to Chloe Potter, who is doing this for the first time.
Thank you very much, Andrew. It's great to be back in here with you in particular.
Have you been doing homework this week? By which I mean, have you been doing anything cultural?
Well, no, I didn't know I was doing this, but I still have done a few cultural things of my own volition.
Whereas I knew I was doing this and have done nothing.
I really enjoyed something this week, a new discovery for me, I'm sure not for other people, but something free that London offers up, which I hadn't realised before, is tours at the Tate Modern and the Tate Britain. And I went along to one at the Tate Modern. And it's 45 minutes to an hour, this tour. It feels like 15 minutes. It's through parts of the permanent collection there. And I went to the Poetry and Dreams one, which is part of the permanent collection at the Tate Modern that I would always pass by, to be honest, because the surrealists don't really appeal to me. But honestly, this was amazing. I really recommend it. This amazing woman called Wendy talks you through some really fascinating pieces of art, and you don't have to spend ages reading the blurb at the side. You just get to absorb the piece of art and enjoy it.
How does it work? Do you have to book in advance, or
you just turn up and they're at 11, 12, 2 and 4, I think, off the top of my head, but check the Tate website. And you just turn up. It was a pretty small group, and we got to get a real insight into a part of the permanent collection that, I would always walk by. I can't recommend it more highly. Picasso, for example. I'm never a huge fan, but she was brilliant, this lady Wendy. She told you really memorable stories about his life that really brought the painting to life. Really moving and memorable.
It sounds great. It's very easy when, I think, if you live in London, to forget that all that stuff is there.
It is.
And that
it really
costs nothing to go and see it.
Yeah, exactly. So much free going on in London. And they also do these apparently at the Tate Britain, which again, I think would just really bring it to life because, you know, you don't really want to do the audio tours and you can literally nip into one of these galleries, get your cultural fix and then head back to work. Try it.
They'll be inundated with requests. Chloe Potter, thank you for that. You are listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
We start this week with some more recommendations for your summer reading, and we're delighted to welcome back literary agent Claire Conville. Claire is co-founder of Conville and Walsh, who represent dozens of authors, including satirist Charlie Brooker, historian Misha Glennie, humorist Marcus Berkman, and songwriter Luke Haynes. Thanks so much for joining us again on The Review, Claire.
Delighted to be here.
Great. You've got four recommendations for us today, haven't you? And I have to say there's a little bit of a theme of male midlife crisis running through. Shall we start with Bitter Experience Has Taught Me?
Nicholas Lezard writes a very good column for The Guardian on sort of paperback of the week. And over the years has led me and many, many other readers to some real sort of literary finds, as well as some literary classics, which may have been sort of slightly forgotten, but which are always worth revisiting. And he writes extremely well about literature. What I hadn't realised was that he writes extremely well about life as well. And Bitter Experience Has Taught Me is based on a series of columns that he wrote for The New Statesman called, originally called Down and Out in London, but eventually just became Down and Out, which I thought was quite funny. But it really is about his life post a very difficult split from his wife and his family, and about living in real poverty orbit in the centre of London, and kind of surviving as a journalist, as a writer, with a family who he sees not as much as he would like, and really with experiencing a great deal of sort of depression and anguish. But what is remarkable, I think, about the book is it's very, very funny, and despite all the sort of difficulties, he is hopeful and insightful, and I really, really ripped through it and enjoyed reading it. And
do you think you have to be a fan of his column in the New Statesman?
No, not at all. I mean, he's always worth reading, as I say, and he's always interesting. But this is a much more sort of conversational, anecdotal-led sort of story. And I think it's kind of good because I think often sort of in divorce, sort of men are perceived as the enemy. Men are the ones who sort of leave the family home, run off with a younger model,
have a fabulous
time while, you know, the sort of wife and mother is left looking after the children and sort of literally and metaphorically holding the baby. And I think Nick here shows us that there is another side to that story, and it can be very, very difficult. But as I say, he finds humour in everything, and I think there's he's part of a great tradition, actually, in English literature of sort of men who find sort of real life absurd. So, you know, he's very funny about paying his taxes or not paying his taxes. He's very funny about the kind of tyranny of receipts. You know, how come you buy a sausage roll for £1.20 and then get a receipt the size of a map you kind of got to carry around with you? So he's very good at picking up on the small details and making a very funny story of them. So he calls himself a feckless boulevardier, which I thought was a brilliant description, and I thought it summed it up. You know, enormous fun, rather stylish, a little bit feckless, but very sweet and rather old-fashioned in its own way.
Nicholas is, as you say, a terrific writer, always has been, very, very funny, and this is a very funny book. But how much of its appeal do you think is, I guess, down to the less funny side of it, the there but for the grace of God aspect of it? Because everybody, you know, roughly his age and indeed roughly my age, will know people who've been in this situation, men who've left a marriage for one reason or another, for reasons that may not even have been their fault, and then had to endure an absolute implosion of their living standards, all of a sudden going from, you know, having the sort of the middle class mortgage and a home and all the rest of it to once again living like a student.
A student.
Having gone through a divorce myself, I mean, I think that emotional truth, whatever the financial circumstances, is what has real impact for me in this. You know, I knew where he was coming from. I didn't have to go and live in a sort of hovel.
That's what you're saying. Yeah.
But I think, you know, the sort of the depression, the sadness, the kind of
the authenticity, and
it was very real to me. And although it's a male experience, it was something I thought anyone could read and enjoy, because, as I say, it is part of a bigger literary tradition, I think, this kind of storytelling, this kind of memoir in English literature. And I just couldn't recommend it highly enough. And actually, as I say, although it's quite a difficult story, he is remarkably up about the small things that work, whether it's finding £4.50 to buy a bottle of wine, or the fact that, you know, the tax authorities now just send a sort of debt collector around once a month, and he just gives the money. He says that suits him perfectly. So there's always, somehow, even in the worst of times, there's an upside.
Mm. And there's a few cameos by other writers in there who are friends of his.
Yeah.
I saw there was one quote from it, Will Self's advice about how to wipe a table. You don't just dab at the visible bits. You know, things like that, him having to get used to.
Well, he quotes Victoria Coren, which I thought was very good. Why is it when men take milk out of the fridge, sniff it, make a face, do they put the milk back in the fridge?
all those amusing cliches.
There's another book which I guess is a slightly different, in fact, entirely different take on the male midlife crisis is John Niven's Straight White Male, which is not dissimilar in some respects, I thought, to his previous novel, Kill Your Friends, which was kind of a hugely entertaining burlesque set in the music business in London. This one sort of sees him setting about the fixtures and fittings of the movie business in Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, I'm biased because I represent John, and I'm a huge fan of his work. Funny enough, I think straight white male, yes, it's a very, I think, very, very funny satire on the film industry. But it's also actually what starts off as another kind of, perhaps looking like a kind of burlesque, turns into actually a much more heartfelt book about a man enduring a midlife crisis. And although Kennedy, who's our sort of anti-hero hero, is sort of irritating, arrogant.
He's a pretty repulsive
character. As the book progresses, we begin to find out more about him and about his life and see a very different side of him. And so, funny enough, although, yes, Kennedy has the trappings of success in a way that Nick Lezard doesn't have in Bitter Experience has taught me, their books are sort of coming out of the same place. And at the end, I would say they've got more in common with each other than they haven't.
Turning to another of your recommendations, Claire, Edith Perlman's Binocular Vision, a collection of short stories that have finally got this writer the recognition she deserves in her 70s.
Yes, it's a really an extraordinary story in a way, and one that occasionally happens whereby a writer who has been writing solidly for, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 years, who's never quite had the critical attention she deserves or the readership she deserves, suddenly you hit the tipping point and everybody's falling over themselves to sort of praise her, fall in love with her stories, fall in love with her. So I was very interested because those kind of literary Cinderella stories are rarer and rarer. So I was very interested to find out more about her and read them. And they are, I think, brilliant. She does what I think Alice Munro does, is that she really writes novels in a short story form. So that the stories are filled with sort of rich characters and dialogues and themes. And one of the stories which I loved, which is in fact the title of the collection, which is called Binocular Vision, was a wonderful quote at the end which says, "Admitting me abruptly into the complicated world of adults, making me understand that I had until then only seen." And I thought that was brilliant because I think that's what she does. I mean, the world she describes is would be very familiar to all of us in a broad sense, but she doesn't just describe it, she makes us truly kind of understand it for the first time,
which is remarkable in the medium of a short story in particular, isn't it?
Yeah, she does. It's a huge. I mean, she's been. This is a big collection of stories written over many years. The other thing about them there is there's a sort of universal vision here. I mean, they're sort of set in countries all around the world. The characters come from all sorts of different backgrounds. Some of them are sort of profoundly sad. There's a wonderful story about a man who's dying of cancer as the Second World War comes to the end, which has a sort of profoundly kind of shocking end to it unexpectedly. And then there are other stories which are much more sort of darker and more satirical in a way. One called Fidelity, which I loved, which is about an ancient writer for a magazine who starts sending in fake, you know, pieces about fake places.
It's a temptation for travel writers. A temptation that has gripped at me a few times. Like, do I really need to bother?
Can I
just crank out the sort of the usual array of cliches and?
In four pages, four or five pages, she also tells the story of an infidelity between the editor and the writer's wife. So it's beautifully done.
And the wonderful thing about the short story format is for all of us time-pressured, busy people, you can just dip into it and get a complete experience, can't you? Even if you just have half an hour.
Yeah, it's perfect for it's perfect for the tube, the bus, the sort of, if you're tired, you know, just one short story before sort of bed. And I really couldn't recommend them highly enough.
It's wonderful that she's finally getting this recognition. Do you think it's hard for writers who don't have a novel under their belt to get that recognition?
I think short stories are notoriously difficult to get published and then B, to have a profile, you know, to kind of, to develop a profile around. I mean, I've had this discussion many times. I think male writers often go on a particular trajectory, which is that they sort of dramatise themselves and their inner lives, particularly at middle age. And I can think of Amis, Barnes, you know, now in fact Jordan Niven. I think women just tend to get on with it. Mm. And then, you know, Hilary Mantel is a classic example of somebody who's been writing wonderful novels for years. And finally, it's come to fruition and she's getting the huge recognition that she's always deserved, frankly, but she hasn't made a fuss about it.
Mm. Well, moving along from the short story, I guess, to the other end of the literary scale, the trilogy.
But another older female author.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. I mean, next time, if you're kind enough to invite me on, I'll make sure everyone's under 30. But all the books, the authors. Jane Cardam's been, I mean, I was reading her when I was in my teens, I think. She's in her 80s now. She's written, you know, fiction for many years and sort of YA novels and for children. This is a kind of, if you like, an. I think the last final flourishing of a really remarkable career as a writer. It's a trilogy, but you don't, as I was saying earlier, you don't have to read the books in order, or in fact you can mix and match. It's a trilogy which started with a wonderful book called Old Filth, continued in The Man in the Wooden Hat.
Which we should remind people is Failed in London, Try Hong Kong. Is
yes,
right?
Yes, something like that. Yeah. Yes, it's yeah. It's exactly. The last book is called Last Friends, and it's about three people: Edward Feathers, in fact, Old Filth of the title, his wife Betty, and a sort of friend, a frenemy of theirs called Terry Veneering. And on the surface, it's about kind of old people, kind of getting through the last years of their life. But underneath, it's about intrigue, love, past betrayal, sort of devastating childhoods. It's the last sort of view of a kind of colonial history where a sort of generation of children grew up without their parents. And it's very, very funny, very dark at times, and extremely sad. Old Phil's story in particular is devastatingly sad. But it's peopled with wonderful characters. Time, I suspect the way time is dealt with in novels rather mirror old age. You move in and out of the past very easily and accessibly. And it, as I say, you don't have to read them in order, but highly recommended too.
Claire Conville, thank you very much as ever for joining us today on The Review. We're going to take a short break now, but when we're back, Nelly Gotcheva will be leading us on a merry cultural dance around the world. Stay tuned.
Aspiring for greener cities and easier commutes, more and more people are switching to bikes. From Zurich to Toronto and on to Buenos Aires, we film pedal makers who've opened up artisanal bike shops to provide bespoke services for two-wheeled enthusiasts.
Frames are recycled and reworked, featuring Monochrome's minimalist design aesthetic. This bespoke upcycling has turned them into one of the Argentinian capital's greenest takes on transport.
Bike shops with a difference. In the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Chloe Potter, and Andrew Muller. Our Toronto Bureau Chief, Nelly Gotcheva, has been as busy as ever digging up the best culture the world has to offer this weekend. And here she is to guide us through it.
This weekend, Vancouver Art Gallery hosts Grand Hotel Redesigning Modern Life. California-based curator Jennifer Volant has put together a photo exhibition looking at various hotels around the world, ranging from the Hilton in Istanbul to Flamingo in Las Vegas and Ace Hotel in Portland. Grand Hotel Redesigning Modern Life is at Vancouver Art Gallery until the 15th of September. In Tokyo, the Mori Art Museum is hosting the All You Need Is Love exhibition. It features 200 works from installations and sculptures to paintings and sketches. Works include Yayoi Kusama's fluorescent Love is Calling installation, David Hockney's My Parents, and Love by Kim Hong-sok, a crushed interpretation of Robert Indiana's original pop art work. All You Need Is Love is on until the 1st of September. Edinburgh's National Galleries of Scotland welcome Peter Doig's No Foreign Lands exhibition. This is the first major show by Scottish painter Peter Doig in his homeland. The series of oil paintings on display are dedicated to the artist's 10 years spent in Trinidad. The show is on until the 3rd of November. For more details, go to nationalgalleries.org. Toronto, entering its 22nd edition, is the SummerWorks Festival, presenting over 30 performances by local and international theatre talent. For this weekend, we recommend How Can I Forget? Featuring Toronto-based artists Suki and Lee, Benjamin Camino and Adam Litovitz, the performance piece incorporates original video, photography and music. The festival is at various venues across Toronto until the 18th of August. For the full schedule, go to summerworks.ca. And finally, on our playlist this weekend, we have the second album by Berlin melodic beatmakers Moderat, appropriately titled 2. And now let's hear them. It's Moderat with Bad Kingdom. For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
And that was Moderat with Bad Kingdom, ending that report by Nelly Gotcheva.
It's time now for our weekly music review, and our music guest this week walks the less trodden path on her audio adventures. So get ready for this week's music segment. We're going to be a little left field.
Farih Bradley is an Iranian-born London-based radio presenter, sound artist, DJ and events curator whose work has mixed academia, site-specific installations and Middle Eastern arts and culture with the outer reaches of experimental audio. She also presents the weekly show Six Pillars to Persia on London's Resonance FM. Welcome to The Review.
Thanks for having me on your ivory tower.
Ivory Tower.
Yeah, beautiful here.
It's
I'm
never
really
been called
impressed.
That before. If only it was a tower. We're actually we're almost underground here, in
but
fact.
It is Monocle HQ.
It is Monocle HQ.
So it hasn't disappointed. It doesn't disappoint.
It does not disappoint. It does look pretty much exactly like the way people always expect it to, which I think is a good thing. Tell us a bit about what it is you do for a start. How would you define the difference between, I guess, normal DJing and what you do?
Well, first of all, beat matching isn't the priority, so I'm not looking for tracks that will match back to back. It's more about it's a bit like curation, actually. You're just looking for something that an intelligent audience will be wanting to hear. So it might be a narrative that's led by rhythm, or it might be a narrative that's led by theme, or it might be, you know, just. As the human being is very complex, so a lot of DJ sets I find very bland because, you know, it's safe rather than exploratory. And yeah, so I play for arts crowds. I DJ for arts crowds. Recently, I was playing in Croatia for a conference that was looking at data freedoms and activism. Yeah.
So because most DJs, which, as you say, have a tendency to play it safe because they're trying to get people to dance, and people will dance more readily to something they recognise.
Yeah.
What sort of reaction are you looking for from audiences? Is it that or sort of beard scratching appreciation?
No, it's definitely dancing. Yeah,
definitely dancing.
Yeah, still. I'm not into all this head nodding and gazing at your shoes. I think you definitely have to listen to music with your body. And if you're sitting down listening to it, I mean, there's different types, aren't there? Obviously, we're talking about sort of DJing. So for DJing, I wouldn't say I was a lounge DJ. No, it's definitely about dancing.
And how much is it a visual performance as well?
Well, that's a really good question. I think, you know, you need inspiration when you're dancing, and the age of the guy staring at the laptop, possibly checking his emails, is over. We really do expect to have a lot of external controllers, and people are going back to digital vinyl, which is really good for me because I often play records that are out of print, you know, like from Iran in the 70s. They stopped making music in 79. It was banned. So a lot of the ones I want to play aren't on record anymore. So digital vinyl allows you to, you know, be out there with your hands doing things while at the same time playing things that you can't get on record anymore.
Mm. What is that pre-revolutionary Iranian music like? I have in my time spent 36 entire hours in Tehran, so obviously I'm a massive expert. But I did spend some of that time with, a Tehran indie rock group, which is obviously a very difficult thing to be. It just struck me that there was such an enthusiasm for music among their peer group, who I did get to spend one entire evening with, that there is this entire history we didn't get to have of Iranian popular music from the 70s onwards. What does the stuff from the pre-revolutionary period sound like? Where was it going?
It was very similar to what was going on in the psych sort of movement in America and Europe in a way. I mean, there were people experimenting with their guitars to make sitar sounds. And there's a wonderful record came out by Kurush Yagmai, who was silenced for many years. And I think last year he came out with a CD release, which has got the sleeve notes that explain everything. He basically tells you through from working as a sort of wedding band to how they adapted stuff made for radio for live performances, because there was nothing there. And it's transformed so much now. I mean, after 79, obviously all psych music and all that kind of, my mum was wearing chippy flares in Iran in the 70s, for example, that all ended. So it's a bit for me like Atlantis, like it just disappeared.
Yeah, and well, that's the thing also about the return to vinyl, isn't it? You get the whole experience. As you say, there's all the explanation and the detail on that record cover, which you don't perhaps get anymore when you just click buy on a library.
Exactly, so. And the tactile thing is missing.
Yeah.
There's also the sense of that you have, there's a contract, like you've given the money for a physical object, and therefore that's not really there with an MP3, I feel, as much, and that's why people are probably quite happy to download without paying.
And Farrie, how do you find, in your world of experimental audio, that part of the music industry, is it welcoming to women? Because the rest of the music industry can at times be a bit of a boys' club, can't it?
Well, this is a really topical discussion, actually. It's very welcoming to women. I mean, why not? It's all about, as we mentioned, the Croatia Festival. It's called Republika. They sort of promote people taking things in their own hands and experimenting and hacking things. And there was a lot of discussion at one of the workshops about whether hacking was a negative connotation. And I think that's a thing for women, is about asking questions, not being frightened to sort of learn, because it's not something you're necessarily taught. And, you know, if you think about the first computer you had, most boys would have had a ZX Spectrum. I had one for some reason, you know, but I don't think many girls would have said on their Christmas list, I would like a toy computer.
Mm. Okay, well, we're going to play the tracks you've brought in. The first one we're going to listen to is one of yours.
Yeah, you worked on this one, didn't you?
This is Move Your Feet With Me.
Oh, yeah, I did all of it. It's just me playing the keys and using Ableton, really.
It's okay, a good place to start.
Let's hear some of it and then we'll talk more about it.
Sorry, we were just touching on how important the context and the visual side of this music experience is. And you did make a video to go with that, didn't you? Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was teaching in a music college at the time, and people were just wearing the most amazing shoes. So I started filming all their shoes and would sort of sing out a rhythm for them to dance to. People in the street, I really enjoyed that, because, as you know, working in radio, when you've got a microphone or a video camera, you've got license to stop people. So yeah, just cataloguing people's shoe wear and their dance moves.
Nice. And how did you translate that into the track?
Well, the song's called Move Your Feet With Me, and I was just thinking about rhythm and what I like to dance to. And, you know, I don't suppose that's 100 miles away from funk, that song.
I was going to say, there is definitely a 70s influence. Is that something that runs through all the music that you work on?
No, not at all. No, I do a lot of sound art, which is very abstract. And I like a lot of very electronic sounding music that makes you think of early computer consoles and video games. Yeah.
Yeah. Talking of abstract, should we have a little listen to the next
track?
Yes,
this is the second track. This is Bill Morrison. Introduce this for us, if you would.
The track is by ex Easter Island Head, who are a duo from Liverpool, very young. And I went to the Curfew Tower last week, and an amazing spot it is. It's basically, you know, I'm beginning to sound a little bit Irish. It's in Antrim, which is a very Protestant-sided area. Beautiful coastland. I would definitely recommend it for a holiday.
It is stunning.
Yeah, and Bill Drummond was the artist who invited musicians to come to the tower for a residency. And normally in these residencies, they would sit and think about the tower and do something quite visual. But Static Gallery from Liverpool put all the artworks that are in the tower in the basement, in incarcerated in a cell, and locked it in the dungeon, and asked the artist to sit alone in the room with a four-track Tascam recorder and do either a field recording or a poem or something that inspired them during their residency. And then they had a launch of this 250 limited edition vinyl, which is on sale at the moment.
The Bill Drummond in question, we should mention to give it some context, is, was one half of the KLF in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, there's a big connection. There seem to be quite a sort of collective. I think they're... I don't know. I don't think he was there, but they had the performers. Ex-East Island Head were there for the launch. And when I walked in, they were playing the wooden stairs of the tower with, padded drumsticks to get ready for their performance.
Well, and what's interesting about this track, given it's in the context of electronica, it's all man-made sounds. There's no computer loops in it at all. And that's sort of their kind of calling card.
Absolutely. They amp up guitars and they use sticks. They do loop the noises, but they're using just a little recorder.
I see.
So they're looping live. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's hear some of that. This is Ex-Easter Island Head. Ex-Easter Island Head. And actually, once you sort of think of it in the context of having been cooked up at least partially in a castle tower, it is rather redolent of, I guess, hunchback retainers wandering around clanging bells.
It is all about the context, isn't it? And how you hear these tracks, perhaps. You know, are you in a crowd? Are you by yourself, as you say, in a room? In a castle tower.
And importantly, what you mentioned, Chloe, which is how are they making it?
Exactly. So you get to see that when you're watching it live.
Yeah, and even if you can imagine how the sounds are being made, you can hear there's a kind of acoustic quality to it. And I think that's something that's really coming back now, is that people, okay, we've enjoyed what digital music has had to offer, but at the same time, we miss sounds that come from the natural world. And I think we respond to that quite well.
Okay, well, the next track you've bought for us, this is an artist that you've interviewed and devoted, indeed, I think, one of your radio shows on Resonance FM to in the past. This is The Cutler. Introduce them, if you would.
Steve Corby and Porky are living in Hull. And this is from an album that came out in 2012 called The Best Things in Life Aren't Things. And I thought that was beautiful. And I was really intrigued with the music, because at that time I was writing something for Dusted, and I had to listen again and again and again. And as you know, as a music reviewer, the music changes the more you listen to it. And I thought there was so much work had gone into this album.
It is one of the infuriating things about writing about music, as I do often, because you're on a quite tight deadline, you actually end up reviewing something and committing to posterity review, which ends up being nothing to do with what you actually end up feeling about the record. It's really embarrassing, especially when you say the record's great and then listen to it a month later and go, God, this is terrible.
Because it has so many layers and your experience grows and develops.
Instance, fewer layers than you thought it did at the time. But this is The Cutler with Pyramid of Power.
Pyramid of Power there by The Cutler. It's pleasing. I don't mean that to be
a
compliment.
It's pleasing. It's amazing to hear it with headphones, because listening on your computer, you miss all the subtleties, all the little sounds. Like there was a tiny little guiro going around and squelchy sounds going on in there. But what's really interesting about that track is that the singer, Andrew Taylor, wrote all the lyrics. And that's what The Cutler do, is they don't tell the singers what to sing. And they play them what they've made and they let them sort of come up with something. So the lyrics for me, I picked that track because it's got a really important narrative, which which is about, you know, one of the problems we're facing today, which is the construct we've made. But anyway, yeah.
Another track you've brought to our attention, this is Late Spring by Hassan K. He's, I believe, a French-dwelling, Iranian-born artist. You've described it, or it is described here in these notes, which I assume were supplied by you, as Iranian Gabba surf music, which is a genre with which I confess to being unfamiliar.
You should have come to the gig.
Next one.
Let's hear Iranian Gabba surf music. This is Hassan K. with Late Spring. That was Hassan K with Late Spring, the fourth and final choice of this week's guest music reviewer, Fari Bradley. Fari, finally and just quickly, do you think we hear there something of that lost, well, not lost history, but I guess lost present we never got to have of Iranian pop music, which kind of got cancelled in 1979?
It is there. It did get lost, but it didn't disappear. It's been going on under simmering under the surface. Sort definitely of, there, yeah.
But is it now mostly within the Iranian diaspora outside Iran?
No, actually, people are risking their freedom to do these things. And I think that what's really interesting about Hassan K is that he develops everything on open source. So it's, you know, in Iran, you can buy a drum kit, but you're not allowed to play it. So there's a lot of survival tactics going on.
Fari Bradley, thank you very much for joining us today on The Review.
It's time now to drop in on a city around the world to hear what's happening there over the coming days. Today we span the globe and land in Hamburg, where Julian Borner reports on some cultural highlights for us.
Hamburg is home to the second biggest seaport in Europe. The docks are very much a part of the city's centre, and they make a fascinating destination for sightseers. You can spend hours sitting on a bench or in a park by the water and watch the ships pass by. You can also venture deep inside the port. Just catch one of the harbour ferries that are part of Hamburg's public transport system. A ride costs around €2, and with its 6 lines and 25 destinations, some say that the ferry system offers the cheapest and the shortest cruises in the world. Until the early 80s, many of the cranes that were used to load ships in the port were built at the Kampnagel plant in the northeast of Hamburg. Today, the former factory is one of the city's most exciting venues for contemporary performance, dance, art and music. This Saturday, as part of the Kampnagel International Summer Festival, Yoko Ono and the guitarist Thurston Moore of the band Sonic Youth are teaming up for an evening of musical improvisation and film. The organizers are promising what they call a wild collision of song, poetry, free rock and ecstasy. Wilhelmsburg is a former working class area of Hamburg that's currently seeing a cultural resurgence. Many students and creative types are moving here to open small shops and cafes. It's also where you'll find Rialto Lichtspiele, a 100-year-old cinema. Covered in cream-coloured tiles, the building still looks like it did when it shut down 26 years ago. Recently, a group of film enthusiasts have reopened the cinema. Until it closes for good at the end of October, there is something on every night, mostly films, of course. But there are also concerts. On Friday, the German language singer-songwriter Felix Mayer will be performing his music. Und kannst nicht fassen, was zu gewinnen geht. For Monocle in Hamburg, I'm Julian Bohne. Nimm Land vor Sonnenblumenschein und
said my digger shake the farm, fuggish my man.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. Up shortly, we'll be crossing from Hamburg to the southern states of America.
The menu brings you the culinary stories and tales that are sure to inspire. From cake, steak and tapas to oysters, chicken and caviar, the menu roams the world in search of the best things to eat and the best places to eat them in. We uncover the trends that are taking hold and interview those spearheading a gastronomic movement.
The spirit in there represents the legacy of everything where we have been involved in the rum-making business. You have to taste it to believe it.
Okay, can we take Peruvian food back to London? A different type of corns, you know, a different type of cheese. And I knew at that stage, yeah, this is good.
So if you don't know the difference between a Salzburger Nockel and Köln Skink, a head cheese and a Falooda, tune into The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time. I hope you're hungry.
That's The Menu, in association with Krug.
Welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with Chloe Potter and Andrew Muller. A couple of months ago on The Review, we welcomed Kathleen Fox-Davies, director of nearby Atlas Gallery, into the studio to talk us through some London photography exhibitions that were catching her eye.
And this time she's gone a bit further afield. Kathleen has just returned from a tour of the southern states of America to see a range of interesting exhibitions, and she joins us once again in the studio to share some of the highlights. Welcome back, I guess.
Thank you very much.
We wanted to start in Dallas, which I believe is your hometown.
Yes, it is.
And this, with an exhibition that is, August? So we've got another 3 months and a bit to go until the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, and it already feels like it's being somewhat over-commemorated. This is an interesting idea while being somewhat macabre.
Very much so. the original idea behind launching this exhibition was actually 50 years ago. The president and the first lady were put up at a hotel called Hotel Texas in Fort Worth, which is now the Hilton downtown, a very normal, almost drab hotel. And the local welcoming committee was embarrassed by how ugly this hotel was. And they had 4 days to round up the best artwork they could gather and curate a show in the three-bedroom suite. The idea of this, they actually published a catalog to go along with it that was in the room. It was a one-night stay. The idea that this was going to tour and really put Fort Worth on the map. And obviously, the next day, on November 22nd, 1963, the president was assassinated in Dallas, and this show never actually came to fruition. So 50 years, they're revisiting this idea. The artwork, there were only 16 pieces that were sourced originally for this show, of which they've gathered 13 back. And most of them actually come from private collections within the Fort Worth community.
That's the astonishing thing, isn't it? That we're talking masterpieces.
Exactly.
And Picassos and things, and they were sourced from people's private collection
community. People just had them.
They just had them
just around the house.
Completely unexpected.
As one does.
Yeah.
For Texas.
Yeah. Well, exactly. That's the other
from
thing.
From a worldview.
It's not the place that you expect to have art connoisseurs.
Not at all. Which actually, growing up in Dallas, I grew up with friends that had Renoirs above their dining room tables.
Wow.
And Monets in their living room. And this was something that I didn't understand was different until I moved away. My family definitely didn't have this, but it's a community that is deeply rich because of the oil businesses in and around Dallas and Houston. And art
is one way to spend it.
Of collecting is a way of almost validating an area of the country that was a little bit forgotten. You know, you're not West Coast, you're not East Coast, but it was bringing some culture in. And there were a lot of very influential citizens that thought that was the most important thing. So you've got the National Museum of Art, the Dallas Museum of Art, where this show is actually being held. Those were all really founded by locals that were actually donating their own artworks. So when you see pieces that come up, they most of the time are not even permanent loans. They're temporary loans from private collections.
How does Dallas feel about this exhibition, and how does Dallas feel about the commemoration of it? Because this and the television program are the two things everybody knows about Dallas, and I'm not sure either of them.
They're not very flattering.
Neither of them are terrific advertisements for a city.
Not at all. The commemoration, I know, is something that is very difficult. It's coming from Dallas. It was a history of what I grew up with. It was the legacy of the city. It was nothing. I didn't know any different. But going away and actually hearing my parents' generation talk about how they were treated when leaving Dallas, going elsewhere, there was a real black mark on the city. So this exhibition will travel. It will actually be back in Fort Worth at the Amon Carter Museum for the actual 50th anniversary.
So who knows? Maybe it will do what it was originally intended to
and
do.
Travel
I kind of imagine Dallas having on the road in, you know, those signs that they have up in workplaces, you know, days without an industrial accident. It's like 50 years without a presidential assassination.
Well, yes.
moving along to New Orleans, which has something of a history itself of, rumbustious politics. I was just thinking Huey Long wasn't actually shot in New Orleans, was he? That was in Baton Rouge at the State House. But anyway, so yeah, that link wasn't as seamless as it seemed in my head. But this is the gallery for, a gallery for fine photography.
A very specific name.
Yes.
For a wonderful, real treat of a gallery. It's located in the French Quarter, which normally, areas such as the French Quarter in a city as New Orleans is, it would be just a trap for tourists. And shockingly, it's not. Once you move away from the sort of crassness of Bourbon Street, you've got two wonderful streets that just border actually either side of Bourbon that are filled with amazing galleries. That some are real, you know, things you can miss, and other things are just, you've got masters, impressionism, you've got amazing photography, which is the Gallery for Fine Photography on Chartres Street. It's owned and operated by Joshua Mann, who is actually the son of a impressionist dealer that has a gallery just around the corner.
So there's a real community,
exactly.
Family history. How much does the recent history in New Orleans dominate the photography that you see there at the moment?
Not that much.
Which is interesting.
It is. With Joshua's gallery specifically, the artists that he's working with are a little bit older. So the ones that I specifically took interest in were working mainly in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, so long before Katrina. But you do see a change in the actual city. And even going in as a tourist, just sitting at a bar, a lot of, even the bartenders will talk about the difference between before and after Katrina and how it's changed the summer tourism.
It was a real road trip that you went on, wasn't it? And you actually made a lovely discovery in a B&B in Atlanta. Tell us about that.
It was a small boutique hotel called Stonehurst Place that was owned and lovingly restored by a woman called Barb, I'm going to say her last name wrong, Chademy. It's a historical home dating back to the early 1800s, which for America is very old. For England, it's just a blink of an eye. But it's a gorgeous craftsman-style architecture. But upon check-in, you walk into the living room and to your bedrooms, and you discover an amazing, sophisticated, intelligent art collection that's actually the owner's own collection that she's used this space to curate her own exhibitions. So you've got sculpture, you've got photography, you've got original Andy Warhol drawings and prints, Nan Golden photography. It's quite incredible and very, very sophisticated, and not something you'd expect.
Well, this is a step up from the artworks that you usually see in bed and breakfast, which tend more towards the dogs playing poker.
Exactly. I thought it was incredibly sophisticated and actually forward-thinking, and walking around this place that has no security, really, for the artwork, I just thought, wow, that's quite brave that she's welcoming people into this hotel, that she's got masterpieces on the walls.
Refreshing
exactly.
Way to see them.
But after 2.5 weeks of touring and eating and listening to music and seeing all sorts of objects in art, it was so refreshing and really pulled everything together to see the things that you saw in galleries and museums in a private setting, and see someone that actually took the time and cared to put it all together.
I also want to talk about the Jackson Fine Art you went to as well
in Atlanta,
too, which is exciting because I've ended up in Atlanta a few times and never quite found much to like about it. I'm writing these down.
Have you been to Jackson Fine Art before?
I have not.
I would say it's in the top five photography galleries in the world. It's an incredible gallery. It was founded by Jane Jackson, who actually left her own gallery to become the director and curator of Elton John's collection. Her eye for art is just incredible, and you still see her mark on everything that that gallery does. They had two artists on when I visited the gallery, which were a strange combination, but somehow it really worked. The first was Richard Benson, and they were these gorgeous color-saturated landscapes of American sort of East Coast settings.
And the process and that's involved is the interesting...
Exactly. Just as important as the subject matter is his printing processes. He is a pioneer in modern printing, and he actually would layer these almost like a skeleton. So it would be their inkjet prints put through the printer, a skeleton would be put on. Then he would put it through another time, reds would be put on. So it's almost like a silk screening process.
When you say inkjet prints, do you mean like the ones that we have on our desks that we're usually swearing at because the computer won't actually do what we're telling it to? Because if that's the case, he's an incredibly patient man.
He's an incredibly patient man. It is the exact same technology on a much more sophisticated scale in an archival fashion, but the technology behind it is the same.
And the result that you get is this really deep saturation of colour.
Of colour, where the image actually looks like what he was taking the picture of rather than a one-dimensional copy of that image.
And finally, an exhibition which isn't in the States, it's in Copenhagen,
yes.
One that is about to happen, which you really recommend.
Which I think is probably the most exciting exhibition of this upcoming autumn season. It's a young artist called Adam Jepsen. The show it will be showing, for lack of a better word, new works from his Flatland Camps project, which the story behind this project is he took 487 days to travel alone from the North Pole to the South Pole through the North America and South America. The images are incredible. He documented his travels with photography and video, carrying the film with him. So the film actually has the markings of his journey through grit that was rubbing on the negatives the entire time. And in the printing process, he really captures that. They're quite stark alien landscapes, both color, black and white, and also utilizing Xerox, which is a bit strange, but absolutely brilliant and works.
How old is he?
He's quite young. He can't be older than 30. He was actually shortlisted back in 2007 for the Deutsche Börse Photography Award, and he's now publishing his second book with Steidl. So he's quite accomplished for a young age, and I think one of the artists to really look at in the next 10 years and what he does with his career.
And is this a departure for him, this idea of journey and record?
He's been working on this this specific project for the last 4 years, and it's something that he thinks he's got 3 more years of developing the work. He's not even actually seen all of the negatives properly from what he took. So it will be exploring that body of work, and that we'll continue to see pieces come out of that. But it is very different from his series before, and I look forward to what he chooses to do next.
And where can people see that?
People can see it at the Peter Lav Gallery in Copenhagen, which is a beautiful, centrally located gallery, very easy to find if you find yourself there. We also have works at the Atlas Gallery, and we'll be showing them in our True Colors exhibition opening at the beginning of September.
Okay, the Adam Jepsen exhibition opens at the Peter Lav Gallery in Copenhagen on the 23rd of August. The final recommendation today of Kathleen Fox-Davies. Thank you very much for joining us once again.
Thank you very much.
And that does bring us to the end of our Saturday review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Mandori House. The show was produced by Katie Bilboa and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Claire Urban.
We're handing back over to Georgina with the weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune in to the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time with Andrew Tuck and Sophie Grove.
You've been listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller, and Chloe Potter. Thanks for tuning in. Have a good weekend.
Bye-bye.